Hello. Today I'm going to provide you some information on IRS resources, such as the IRS website, authorization forms, the Taxpayer Advocate Service, the National Taxpayer Advocate, the Taxpayer Assistance Centers, and stakeholder liaisons.
Welcome to Tax Justice Warriors, the podcast that celebrates the work of low-income taxpayer clinics, focuses on tax controversy work, and looks at related issues in tax news. I'm your host, William Schmidt, the director of the Low Income Taxpayer Clinic at Kansas Legal Services.
I wanted to talk today about IRS resources available to taxpayers and various practitioners. The IRS website itself, irs.gov, has guidance, videos, and other reference. They allow a taxpayer to make payments, to look up various tax records, check on the status of refunds, check on the status of amended tax returns. There are also IRS videos available on the IRS website or on YouTube that help to explain IRS policy or procedures that can be helpful for, especially for a taxpayer or the practitioner to deal with a new situation with the IRS. There are different authorization forms available through the IRS. You can go to the IRS forms and publications or just do a search on the IRS website. Two of the main forms used are Form 8821, Tax Information Authorization. This form gives the representative authority to find out information such as transcripts or to speak to the IRS, but not to represent the taxpayer on specific matters before the IRS. The practitioner can find out information, but not make changes on the account. One difference between Form 8821 and Form 2848 is there is a column D. Column D is specific tax matters. This is specific information that the person wants the IRS to provide. Some examples are lien information, balance due amount, specific tax schedules, Section 4980H employer shared responsibility payment information, or tax liabilities. And also there is line 4, specific use not recorded on a CAF number. Examples of these specific uses are request to disclose information to loan companies or educational institutions, request to disclose information to federal or state agency investigators for background checks, request for information on Form SS4, application for employer identification number, the Form W-2 series, Form W-4, W-7, 843, 966, 1096, 1098, the 1099 series, 1128, 2553 or Form 4361. I do use Form 2848, the Power of Attorney form. I will go a little bit through the form in more depth. I use this form to represent the taxpayers on specific matters before the IRS. This is a different form than what is necessary for tax court. That requires filing a entry of appearance with tax court. So just because a person has a power of attorney with the IRS does not mean that they are authorized to appear before tax court and vice versa. So when listing a taxpayer identification number, that is the Social Security number, the ITIN, the Individual Taxpayer Identification Number, or the EIN, the Employer Identification Number. So that is the EIN is for businesses. I mentioned a CAF number before. The CAF number is from the Central Authorization File. The number represents a file containing information regarding the type of authorization taxpayers have given representatives for the various modules within their account. They will use that number when putting on Form 8821 or Form 2848, and also when speaking with the IRS on the phone to speak about what their authority is, to speak about what authority they have to talk to the IRS. Now, the IRS also confirms CAF numbers. They will also ask the practitioner what is their Social Security number and their date of birth. This is a further step that the IRS does to try and prevent fraud. So this may be something that can be a little uncomfortable to the practitioner, but it is part of the IRS security that they are using to try and make sure that the correct person is checking on the taxpayer's information. So the CAF number is assigned by the IRS. If an individual does not have one assigned yet, they need to write none in the box. There is also a box where the representative can indicate that they should be copied on all IRS notices and communications to the taxpayer. I have found out that this is not an absolute time where the representative receives everything sent to the taxpayer, but it does allow the representative to receive quite a bit of information that they otherwise would not have, so that they can be a bit more clued in as to what's happening on the taxpayer's account. There are boxes for the description of matters, tax form numbers, and years or periods, so it is necessary to be specific about the kind of authority that the representative needs for the taxpayer. So, for example, I use income, Form 1040, and multiple years for a person. Right now I'm listing from 2001 through 2019. Since the IRS can go for a 10-year period on collecting on a particular tax year, I like to check for more than 10 years. I also list a couple years beyond the last tax year, because sometimes working with the taxpayer, they wind up needing assistance beyond the current tax year. Something else gets audited, something else gets messed up, so I do list a couple extra tax years. Now, the IRS will treat what is listed literally, so they're not going to discuss other matters with the representative, so it may be necessary to submit another form to research in that additional area. Some examples of other matters would be employment, payroll, excise tax, state tax, gift tax, whistleblower, practitioner discipline, Freedom of Information Act, civil penalty, Section 5000A shared responsibility payments, Section 4980H shared responsible payments. Those are just some of the examples of the descriptions of matters listed on the Form 2848. But if you are representing someone besides just individual income matters, then it may be necessary to file another Form 2848 just to work with the IRS on getting information on those specific matters. Now, if a person is withdrawing a Form 2848, they do need to write the word withdraw at the top of the first page with a current signature and date below the annotation. So for each person who is withdrawing, each of them needs to be writing at the top of the page. On the form, you need to list additional acts authorized. There are boxes for additional acts authorized. There are lines there to write in specific additional acts. I generally write in any additional act necessary to resolve a tax controversy. I have learned that clicking all of the boxes can cause an issue because clicking on the box that says sign a return requires additional steps. There are instructions to write further information on the power of attorney, and that has caused my power of attorney forms to be rejected by the CAF unit. So I do not click that box, though clicking the other boxes will allow the power of attorney form to go through and be processed. Some of the people who can be authorized on a power of attorney form are a CPA, an attorney, or an enrolled agent. Qualifying students can also be listed on the power of attorney for a low-income taxpayer clinic or a student tax clinic program. They have to be law, accounting, or business students. Now, there are additional steps to be taken to allow these students to be authorized. Generally, law schools are familiar with taking these additional steps to allow these students to be authorized, but I'm not going to go into that information at this point. I'm going to turn now to the Taxpayer Advocate Service. As a whole, the service works to assist taxpayers with individual problems and recommending systemic changes within the IRS. Over time, they have listed what their main four general categories are for prioritizing who to assist with the IRS. Number one, where a taxpayer is experiencing some financial difficulty, emergency or hardship, and the IRS needs to move much more faster than it usually does or even can under its normal procedures. In those cases, time is of the essence. If the IRS doesn't act quickly, for example, to remove a levy or release a lien, the taxpayer will experience even more financial harm. Number two, where many different IRS units and steps are involved and the case needs a coordinator or traffic cop to make sure everyone does their part, the Taxpayer Advocate Service plays that role. Number three, where the taxpayer has tried to resolve a problem through normal IRS channels, but those channels have broken down. And number four, where the taxpayer is presenting unique facts or issues, including legal issues, and the IRS is applying a one-size-fits-all approach, isn't listening to the taxpayer, or doesn't recognize that it needs new guidance for those circumstances. So that isn't a strict limit on what the Taxpayer Advocate Service will do for a taxpayer. They list some other categories, but the main one is economic burdens for the taxpayer. That is a main issue where the Taxpayer Advocate Service will step in for the taxpayer. I found the Taxpayer Advocate Service to be quite helpful to me as a low-income taxpayer clinic director. They can look up quite a bit of information for me because they have various IRS databases. They have also been quite helpful for me when there are identity theft issues for a taxpayer or when there is a taxpayer refund offset bypass. A taxpayer refund offset is when their refund would be intercepted by a government agency to pay on a past due debt that the taxpayer has with the government. The Taxpayer Advocate Service has been able to bypass those refund offsets when there would be a financial burden to the taxpayer above and beyond the loss of that refund. So they can do this for an IRS debt just to know that if there are other government debts that the taxpayer owes, those need to be dealt with separately, specifically with those organizations, such as a state Department of Revenue, or I have dealt with a taxpayer who owed a debt to the VA, the Veterans Administration. So that involves setting up a payment plan or paying off that debt separately before then the IRS debt itself can be dealt with. To do this offset bypass, the financial hardship needs to be proven. Recent bills will need to be provided, but especially ones with that financial hardship, such as utilities being shut off, denial of medical care, or another hardship that may prevent the taxpayer from addressing their basic needs. So it may be a loss of a home, a vehicle, a phone, something that will help them get to work or get that medical care that they need. Those loss of issues are something that may build up to help the taxpayer get as much of their refund as Taxpayer Advocate Service can. I always would suggest getting involved with a taxpayer advocate as soon as you know that a taxpayer is filing for a refund, but they have these issues, that talking with the Taxpayer Advocate Service, they may have specific procedures that it's necessary, so it's worth communicating with them as closely as possible. Now, the National Taxpayer Advocate is the head of the Taxpayer Advocate Service. Her name is Nina Olson. She has a background with the Low Income Taxpayer Clinic program. I believe she is a zealous advocate. She is quite outspoken for low income taxpayer needs. She provides written statements to Congress. She does an annual report to Congress every January and an objectives report to Congress every June. Each of those reports gives additional feedback on the previous report, what has happened in those roughly 6 months, the halfway point throughout the year, what kind of progress the IRS has made. This is the National Taxpayer Advocate's report to Congress about that. So she gives feedback on IRS performances to Congress on issues like customer service, taxpayer treatment, tax legislative impact, and other issues. She lists the most serious problems and recommendations to Congress. These reports are submitted independently from IRS review. So she is giving these reports that these are not crafted by the IRS. This is an independent review where she is listing what kind of issues the IRS has, submitting that to Congress, that perhaps they can provide legislation that would impact those issues. Another service that practitioners may not be aware of is the Practitioner Priority Service telephone line. That is 1-866-860-4259. Again, that's 866-860-4259. There is a telephone call tree available. To call the practitioner priority service, an individual must have that kind of authorization that I spoke about before, the Form 8821 or the Form 2848. That will be necessary to prove a practitioner's authority on who they are authorized to speak about and get information. Just to give a little bit of information about the phone tree, number one is general tax law questions, including filing a return or tax rules and regulations. Number two is questions about individual accounts that are not in collection or examination status. Number three is questions about business accounts that are not in collection or examination status. Number four is if a client's account is in the automated collection system status. Number five is dealing with questions about an automated underreporter notice, AUR. Number six is for a client's account that is under correspondence examination. And you can look at the IRS website to see examples of various questions you may have under those different categories on the phone tree. I would also recommend a taxpayer go to the Taxpayer Assistance Center. These are local public places that the taxpayer can speak to the IRS. A taxpayer will need an appointment, so they would need to call 1-844-545-5640. Again, that is 844-545-5640. I recommend this for situations where the taxpayer does need to talk to the IRS in person. It may be that they have trouble getting a hold of the IRS on the phone and need to speak to them specifically. One instance, though, that worked for me was I was assisting a person who had a power of attorney for her mother and was trying to sort through what problems her mother had with the IRS. We went in person and we were able to speak to the IRS at the Taxpayer Assistance Center and find out that the IRS debt had expired, but it specifically helped that we were able to talk to the IRS at the Taxpayer Assistance Center in person, because trying to explain the situation over the phone just would not have worked. The final piece of the IRS resources that I am going to mention is the Stakeholder Liaison Program. The stakeholder liaisons establish relationships with practitioners and industry organizations representing small business and self-employed taxpayers. They provide information about policies, practices, and procedures IRS uses to ensure compliance with the tax laws. They also elevate issues that affect tax administration. Now, I've worked with my local stakeholder liaison that, for one thing, I receive emails from the stakeholder liaisons that some of these can be a bit of the IRS marketing materials and seeing what the IRS is trying to communicate to taxpayers and different organizations. But I have also been able to attend meetings set up by the stakeholder liaison where various departments with the IRS are speaking about their roles and different initiatives going on within the IRS. And the stakeholder liaison was also able to set up the Kansas City campus tour that I spoke about in episode 7. I recommend, if you are a practitioner, to reach out to your local stakeholder liaison, that there may be resources or events that the stakeholder liaison knows about that they may be able to connect you to that otherwise a practitioner may not have been aware of. Now, I certainly recommend checking on the IRS website for different events as well, but I hope overall all of these IRS resources I mentioned will be useful to you. The IRS website, authorization forms, the Taxpayer Advocate Service, the National Taxpayer Advocate. She does a regular blog that lists different systemic issues within the IRS. This is great reading that a person can learn about both the National Taxpayer Advocate, but about different systemic issues in the IRS, and perhaps give you ideas on how you can help taxpayers on a more systemic level. The Taxpayer Assistance Centers, the stakeholder liaisons, all of these are various resources that can help practitioners. I hope they help you in representing taxpayers. Thank you for listening to Tax Justice Warriors. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to Tax Justice Warriors. We have a Patreon page if you'd like to support this podcast. Providing monetary support for this podcast helps with expenses like equipment or travel to tax conferences. Supporting this podcast through Patreon comes with rewards, so check out our Patreon page. Please rate or review this podcast because positive reviews help get more people to know this podcast exists. The views expressed on this podcast are not official opinions of the IRS, the Low Income Taxpayer Clinic program, or the employers of the people who spoke on this program. Your tax situation is unique, so do not take the statements on this program as tax or legal advice. Consult with your own tax professional to provide you with specific advice on your situation. Tune in next time on Tax Justice Warriors for another interesting tax discussion.